So my name is Kurt Hillegas, and I'm going to talk to you today about building a successful cyber infrastructure program that we've done at Princeton University. And hopefully it's something that you'll be able to do as well. Having been on multiple sides of the coin for the past 20 years, first as a researcher, doing my graduate work, getting my PhD in chemistry, and then as a system administrator, a systems programmer, doing everything from system administration through email configuration, through mass storage, building mass storage systems, and finally as a manager, managing teams for the past 10 years. The one thing that I've found is always true is that unless you build partnerships, you're not going to be successful. So by the end of our time together today, hopefully you'll clearly understand how partnerships are important in building a successful cyber infrastructure program. And I'll give you some examples of the things that we've done at Princeton that hopefully may be helpful in your environment, helping to improve or build a program if these things fit in the university of your university. The first thing I'd like to start with is building a little bit of context. I've said cyber infrastructure at least 15 times already, and it's on the screen. So who has a good definition of cyber infrastructure? Does everyone know what cyber infrastructure is? All right, can you come up and take... sorry. So the term was really brought into popular usage by the Atkins report, the Blue Ribbon report for the NSF, that was in 2002, I believe. And it's been bandied about. That was a very long report and therefore not a very concise definition. There have been a number of things that have come up to putting definitions forth. But about 2 years ago, EDUCAUSE and the Campus Cyber Infrastructure Group and the Coalition for Academic Scientific Computing got together and did a report. And part of that report was they created a definition that really fit for what I'm going to be talking about today. So I'll read along as you read. Cyber infrastructure consists of computational systems, data and information management, advanced instruments, visualization environments, and people, all linked together by software and advanced networks to improve scholarly productivity and enable knowledge breakthroughs and discoveries not otherwise possible. So this is basically all the things that enable research and teaching at a university. I'm going to be concentrating pretty specifically on the research computing areas, but there's all the things that go with teaching as well and scholarly works and stuff like that. And hopefully Tom, actually, we found that we complement each other quite well, and he'll be talking about a lot of the stuff that I'm not talking about. One of the things that I want to stress is that my job is not to build the best cyber infrastructure in the world. My job's not to build the biggest supercomputer in the world. My job is to enable research, right? And the faculty drive the research. So that's a key context of what's going on here. It's not to build the biggest, best, fastest thing. It's to make it so that the research can get done more quickly so scientists can do knowledge discovery, knowledge building and discovery. A little bit about what we're going to talk about today before we dive right in. So first I'm going to talk about the process, a little bit of a history lesson of what we've gone through building our cyber infrastructure at Princeton University. Then I'm going to go on to talk about the current successes and challenges that we're working with. And finally, I'll talk just a very little bit about some of the opportunities that we have ahead of us that we may be able to capitalize on. And finally, we'll summarize, and hopefully the summary will be many of the lessons that I've learned along the way. Let's just start right at the beginning. So in the beginning, we had the situation that resulted from the 80s and 90s. Right? IT people, you know, we were great. We knew everything. And we told researchers, this is how you're going to do it. We've bought your computer, and this is how you're going to use it. And in the 80s, it became cheap enough that they said, to hell with you. I'm going to go buy my own and use it the way that I know how to use best because I know how to use it the best. And so we needed to get over that, right? What happened in the 90s is that we started using bigger and bigger systems that the faculty were having more trouble dealing with themselves. The graduate students were spending more and more time, thank you, doing that. That's how I went from being a chemist to being an information technology person. And people needed to come together. So at Princeton, in 2002, three things happened all at the same time, and it wasn't coordinated. So these three things were my group, which actually at the time was called Research and Academic Application Support. I talked with Betty Lydon, the CIO, and I said, the university really needs to be supporting the researchers in doing computational research. So we formed this group. At the same time, the faculty were forming a group called the Princeton Institute for Computational Science and Engineering. So this is an academic institute at the university that's designed to bring researchers together to collaborate on computational issues. So to do research computing, bring the computer scientists with the mathematicians and the domain scientists together to really do what they can't do independently. And finally, we formed the Research Computing Advisory Group, which is a group of OIT staff, IT staff from academic departments, and faculty members that get together. When we first formed it, we got together about once a month during the semesters. Now we meet four times a year, and that's all we need. It's developed to the point where we've got the communication. We can keep things going without meeting so often. In fact, it was getting very difficult to come up with an agenda that was useful eight times a year. The first thing that we had to do once we had gotten things together, so we had a way to do governance. We had a way to bring people together and collaborate. But we had to overcome what happened in the 80s. We had to start building trust. If the faculty did not trust the IT staff that we were going to do what they needed to have done and enable their research rather than trying to fit our own agenda, they weren't going to work with us. And on the flip side, if the faculty weren't going to respect us as contributors, we weren't really going to work very well with them. So we did a number of things. The first thing that the Research Computing Advisory Group said to us was, why would we ever want you to take care of one of our clusters? You've never done it before. So we went off and we worked with Dell and developed a great deal. We got a small computational cluster. It was 32 nodes, two single core processors in each node. We put it together, and that cluster is still in service today. It's actually been replaced with new hardware, but it's still in service, and it still provides a level of service that's necessary at our university. But it also was proof that we can set one of these up, we can do it in the right way, we're learning, we're willing to do what you're asking us to do. There was also the Princeton Software Repository. There used to be this old thing called /user/Princeton. Which was software, open source software, built and configured mostly for Solaris and IRIX at the time, to work in the Princeton environment. And it was a mess. It was over 700 executables. You can't really call them packages. Who knows what was associated with what? The faculty were frustrated by it. So they asked us to develop a repository that would be more forward-thinking. And we went off and we did that in a way that they liked. And actually, that service has now been retired because it's no longer useful. That service was for Linux and Solaris, and Solaris has gone by the wayside, and if you can't get the package, some kind of a Red Hat package for an RPM for Linux, it's probably not a package worth having. Or, you know, we actually have someone who makes them very easily. The university internet connectivity was huge. Our physicists needed internet connectivity, and we went around and around and actually acted as the liaison between the researchers and the network people to translate and to get those needs to look much less like demands and more like needs, and to make it so that the networking people didn't seem unreasonable, that they were really talking from a technical standpoint. At the same time, there was a person in Pixie, actually he wasn't in Pixie at the time, he was in another institute at the university, who was taking care of old supercomputing hardware. He continues to do that, in fact he's in my group today, but that was very important. The faculty trusted him, they trusted what he did, and he did an excellent job. He did what they needed. We also have a member of our math staff who has built the Elders image, which is a rebuilt Red Hat distribution that's built and configured for the Princeton environment. And he basically rebuilds it all from scratch, and he tests things. It's actually more reliable. We get less failures from his distribution than from Red Hat because he tests it before he sends it out. He tests it in our environment. So that's as we started to build trust. And the faculty really trust what he did as well. He was providing an important service to the university. Once we had trust, we could start building relationships. So probably a bit orthogonal to what we were doing, but maybe not. The university had really taken a strategic position that we were starting to look at research computing as a strategic initiative in the university. At the same time, our engineering school did a strategic plan, and as a result of that strategic plan, they hired 3 senior faculty members who were involved in some way in research computing. One of those faculty members, Emily Carter, suggested that what we should do, she came to the university and she didn't know what was provided as centralized support for research computing. She said, why don't you have an annual meeting, do it through RCAG, where you invite every faculty member in the university who might be in some way interested in what support you're providing. So we sent out invitations to 150 faculty or so, and we had huge success the first year. We actually had to have 2 meetings because there was so much content and there were so many people that it was really amazing. We were having a great conversation with the faculty. And then all of a sudden, wow, we got to the point of exactly what we're looking at here, building relationships and building partnerships. In the middle of one of these meetings, a faculty member stood up and she looked at me and said, Kurt, you and everyone who works for you is totally incompetent, and I would never put any of my stuff on a system that you're taking care of. So I could have gone back to my old academic ways and started barking back at her, but I didn't. I said, I hear what you're saying. And she also said, those 2 people that I mentioned, the guy from the math department and the guy who was taking care of old systems, she said, you need to include them in anything you're doing. And I said, of course. Of course we'll include them in what we're doing. And I hear what you're saying. We'll work on our competencies in this area, and we'll continue to provide better service. The great thing about this is, now that faculty member has actually left the university since then, but before that faculty left the university, there was a contribution of well over 6 figures towards one of our systems. In 5 years or so, we had done enough. We had built the trust with her to get her to the point where she was contributing major amounts of money to what we were doing. So around that time, we had a number of faculty members sit back and say, we want to buy something, we want to buy something collaboratively, and we want this to be centrally administered. That was really exciting. And what happened is a bunch of faculty members stood up. We had central funds contributed from Betty Lyden. We had funds contributed from the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. But we had individual faculty members. This was the first thing that we had done. Individual faculty members gave $100,000 each. It was pretty phenomenal. And what we realized through this process of building the system was that instead of building relationships, what we really needed to be doing was building partnerships. We needed to be building situations where we came to the table, we understand what strengths the faculty have. The faculty understands what strengths we have. And rather than saying, I know how to do it right, say, well, these pieces I know can kind of fit together, but how would you do this piece that I know you're better at? We have a conversation. Right? That's what a partnership is, and that's the difference between a partnership and a relationship. If we go back to the faculty member who was screaming at me, we had started to build a relationship. It wasn't a very good one at the time, but it was a relationship. That person did not trust my group and was not willing to come to the table with my group and say, you know something. There's something you can know that can contribute to my research, and I know something about this, so I can help you do it better. And that's what we really need to be doing with partnerships. So I just put this up here because there were a number of faculty through Pixie who had gotten together and bought an SGI Altix system. That system has actually grown and has had central contributions. It's still in production. Amazingly, it hasn't fallen apart yet. It's a very old system. But we also bought a single rack IBM BlueJeans, and it was a huge success. It was utilized for the first couple of years. It was utilized 80%. People were working together well. They were getting out of the way from each other when they needed extra time. It was really good, and we started to develop the model by which we're working now. So it's collaborative administration. And what happened at this point is Bill Wixer, who is this person who is doing system administration for older systems, started working with us to work on the system. He still was totally independent of my group, but we worked together. We collaborated. There were no fees for the system administration, and there were no fees for housing the system in our server room. It was so successful that within 6 months, we went out and we bought a fairly large Beowulf cluster. And so I put these things up on the screen, not because that's our success, right? Our success was building these partnerships. That's the metric of our success, that we were able to start collecting funding. The amount of funding that was provided centrally for the IBM BlueJean was about 50%. The amount of funding that was provided for the Dell Beowulf cluster was about 20%. The rest came from faculty. And what we did is we built a steering committee of faculty members who were involved who had contributed to the system, so they could help to determine the policies, mostly the policies for scheduling, which is where most of the issues come up with the clusters. There are always challenges. As you get success, the next challenge comes stepping onto your door. So the next challenge for us was storage. And we started having enough success that we had two major junior faculty hires. These were two of the brightest stars that were rising up as junior faculty members, decided to come to Princeton. But when they came to Princeton, we have one of them who works with HDF5 files that are over a terabyte. All of a sudden, we had no storage systems to deal with it. So we went off and we bought 35 terabytes of GPFS storage. We thought it was great. We thought it was wonderful. These junior faculty members got together and they bought a cluster, which was, you know, fairly good size. And what happened is we put it into production. And basically, CIT or OIT paid for half of the system. And the provost contributed half of the funding and said that the faculty would need to pay that back over the next 3 years as through fees for service. So for the first few months, it wasn't used very much. And so you can probably guess when we had this meeting. We had a meeting where Betty Lydon was there, and she said, "This is ridiculous. We have this great new resource." And you can see at the beginning here, very little usage down there, maybe 10% usage. When we did analysis on that storage, that was actually the benchmarking data that we had done to prove that the thing could perform the way it was supposed to perform. There was almost no research data on there. And Betty, who's usually very, very mild-mannered, in her strongest tone said, "I will never do this again, but this is a waste of the university's resources. I will pay for the rest of that system. Researchers have to use this." Who can guess what date that happened on? April 7th, exactly. And within 4 to 6 months, we had the thing at 95% utilization. And so now we had a problem. Our success once again became another problem. So we sat down with the faculty members and we talked to them at the ARCAG meeting. And we said, "What do you want? What storage would work for you?" And they sat down and they described almost exactly what you would look up in a textbook for hierarchical storage management system. So we went off to the vendors. We talked to a number of vendors. There were very few vendors who could actually do real hierarchical storage management all the way to tape. In fact, there were two at the time. One was SGI and one was IBM. So we ended up going, with an IBM system. We got a petabyte of storage, and about the first 100 terabytes, maybe 90 terabytes, is fast fiber channel disk. The second 200 terabytes is SATA disk, a little bit slower. The first tier is about 800 megabytes a second. Second tier is 400 megabytes a second. And then the rest is a tape library that can grow. We set a petabyte, but it can continue growing. If we need to, we can even start vaulting tapes. Of course, success keeps bringing more new challenges. We've gotten to the point where we're so successful that we're doing major hires based on the fact that Princeton has the resources that we have and the support for research computing. So we hire a new faculty member. With his startup funds and with funds from other faculty members, we built a large cluster, our largest cluster so far, 448 nodes. It's 3,500 cores, which is pretty big. It's not the biggest cluster in the world, but it's pretty big. It certainly could toast bread if you put the bread behind it. And, of course, this new faculty member coming in wants to do things the way he did it at his old institution. The way our scheduling works is you get priority based on how much you've contributed. Anyone can use the system. If you haven't contributed, you can put a small proposal in, 2-page proposal, and we've never really turned someone down. We've led one or two people in different directions because they weren't going to the right resource. But anyone in the university who has a reasonable research project that will work on our hardware can use it. All of a sudden, these faculty members come in and they say, I want this part to be my part of the machine. I want instant access. I don't want to have to wait at all. And this has totally messed up our scheduling, right? Because one of our prides is that we get near 80% utilization on everything all the time. And that builds a very strong argument with the senior administration of the university. All of a sudden, we chop them up into pieces and things don't fit in, and we start getting utilization numbers that are down in the 50%. So this is one that we're still working on. We've gotten some progress in making it happen better, but it's a work in progress. We're actually talking with vendors to do something to get different scheduling software. We also decided that some of the part, as people are moving in, we now have system administrators in academic departments who no longer have responsibility for these systems, but they're supporting them. They're supporting the Linux workstations. So we started the supercomputing pipe scientific computing administrators meeting, SCAM. Yes, we're geeks. Yes, we have a regular expression in our name. It was specifically chosen that way. And we get together about once a month all year and talk about random topics of interest to helping support. And this is to build community eventually to get to a point where we're doing a new initiative that we're working on, where I will help to supervise those people in their regular work. The departments still have control. The departments are still their managers. But I can help to supervise their work, and they can actually start now working on the central systems as well as the systems in their own departments. Another thing that we created is DataSpace, which is an archival storage for basically allowing people to put data or publications up on the web and have persistent URLs associated with them. We're finished now with the history, so let's talk a little bit about what cyber infrastructure looks like at Princeton now. Research computing base, that's the people I keep talking about. The people are the most important part of this. On top of that, you've got to build the HPC hardware, and I have a slide about the HPC hardware, so I won't talk about that right now. And storage. So that's our HSM storage system that I talked about. These are the two components that people get pretty regularly. They actually usually don't think about the people. They think about the fun toys. But there's software, and software is hugely important. We actually have a group of two programmers who help people to build their codes, tune their codes. We write codes from scratch with them. We do like to teach the faculty to fish, but we'll work with them to enable their research. And that actually may be more important than providing the hardware for the faculty members. Programming support helps with the software. So on top of the programming support, we also supply compilers, things like that, software, libraries. And visualization, this is another one I'll talk about a little bit. We have a visualization lab that's been quite successful, and we're in the process of leapfrogging it into more success. There's the infrastructure of the university. So there's the data center, there's the network, all those things that go along with building cyber infrastructure. And finally, collaboration. So it's not just the people, it's bringing the people together. There's more than this. We're not totally complete, but this is how cyber infrastructure looks at Princeton right now. Yes?
Do you have a dedicated data center for research?
No, I'll talk about that in a minute. I'm going to talk about our new data center that we're building.
You seem to be able to add systems in the cloud.
Yes. And that's part of the process. I'll talk in a minute about the data center. So this is just a list of our current hardware. We have 5 major systems. 4 of them are some sort of Beowulf cluster. 3 of the Beowulf clusters are Dell. 1 is an SGI, Altix Ice. And then we have Hecate, which is our Itanium-based SGI Altix BX2. We're desperately hoping to replace that. We're working on funding right now to replace that with a larger system. It would be 8 terabytes instead of 1 terabyte and many, many more cores. But that's what things look like right now. And I put that up not to say that that's our success. There again, This is the metric of our success, that we've been able to build and sustain this portfolio of systems that cover the broad range of needs of our faculty. I said I'd talk about visualization for a little bit. In fact, I have really good news on this. We actually had that first bullet item. We had a visualization analyst that worked with us for about a year and a half. He left the university, and just yesterday I got email confirmation that we have a fully accepted offer and acceptance from our new guy, Michael Chupa, who's coming to us from CHOP, and we're very excited about that. The visualization expert really helps people to go. He goes not just into our visualization lab. We have a visualization lab with this large projection screen. But more importantly, he goes into people's labs, and he works with the people in their labs, enabling them to do visualization where they work normally. And then they get frustrated because their screen's this big, and they can't see it all. And that's when they really need to come in and use our large display, which our display right now is designed. It was very inexpensive, and it was designed to have lots of pixels on the screen. We had also designed a much larger system, more than an order of magnitude more expensive, had multiple panels of this and that and the other thing, and stereo, and we realized we went around about it the wrong way. The central administration was not very supportive, and they weren't supportive because we had not gotten the momentum of the faculty behind it to do the right thing. So there again, we're relearning some of our lessons. So what we did is we went and built this smaller, start small, do it well, and it's going to grow. We have a collection of open source and proprietary software that we provide, not only on our visualization lab, but we license everything that can be licensed for anywhere in the university. They can get a floating license and use the same software in their lab that they're using on our central system. So this one's really exciting, and we actually have some people in the room who are helping us to do this. We have a couple of people from CS Technology who are our owner's reps for building our new high performance computing research center, which is the new university data center. And as I said before, this is going to be a shared data center. It'll have enterprise systems in it as well as high-performance computing systems in it. We also have a small... We currently have a data center that's going to be abandoned because it's very old. It was built in the 60s, and it needs to be replaced. That's what this will be replacing. We also have a small data center on the other side of campus where we do some reliability stuff, so we have backup systems and such. And actually, most of the production is running in the smaller server room right now. But this project has been the pinnacle of how partnerships work. It's amazing to hear stories from some other universities who have built data centers and how they didn't get along with facilities and facilities didn't get along with them, and it was a struggle all along. Somehow, and I think a big part has been not only because of John Ziegler, who's the university's project manager for the project, but also because of CS Technology, who's helped a lot with the project. People come to the table, and when we get to the point where it has to do with high-performance computing and the heat that my systems are going to produce and that stuff, CS Technology, all the engineers look to me and say, what's the right thing to do here? What do we need to be thinking about? Whereas when it gets to the cooling systems and how the infrastructure of the cooling systems work, please, mechanical engineers, take care of that for me. I will trust your judgment. This is what I want it to look like on my side. I think about how I used to behave with the networking people. And I've actually learned over the years not to behave this way. I knew a little bit about networking. So I would go to Peter Olenek, our networking manager, and I would say, look, I have this new system. I want it exactly like this. I want a connection here, and I want it to go there, and I want it on this kind of fiber, and blah. And he would get grumpy. And I didn't understand why. I finally learned over the years to go to him and say, and unfortunately he's retired from the university, he was a very great asset to the university, but I learned over the years to go to him and say, look, I have this system that I need to bring in. These are the performance issues that I need to think about. What would your suggestions be for best implementing something to get this in place? And that is exactly how this project has worked with our data center. Everyone has come to the table willing to listen to what other people are having to say. And it's all of these people, OIT, Pixie, the provost, facilities, RCAG, our outside contractors, all of us have come to the table willing to work, and it's been hugely successful. And I can put this up. This was taken yesterday. We have webcams up. You can see we have footings. It's really exciting. We have waited almost 10 years to build a new data center, and the day that they started shoving dirt around, we were jumping up in the air, and it was really exciting. And when they started shoving dirt around, we didn't even have a permit. They were just allowed to scrape a little bit of the grass off of the top. So, but this is really exciting. We're scheduled to go live in about a year, August, September time frame next year. And we're going to very aggressively then move all of our systems from our existing data center into this new data center.
Is it only going to be research?
No, it's research and enterprise.
And enterprise, what level?
It's going to be about a 2. It's going to be about a 2. We will have generator backup, 2 kinds of generator backup. For the enterprise side, there's going to be a diesel generator. To cover the rest of the utilization, it's going to be about a 5 megawatt building, 3 megawatts to the raised floor. For the rest of that capacity, we're going to have a gas generator. And that gas generator, its purpose is really to be doing peak shaving. Because, you know, we pay minute by minute for our electrical capacity, and that changes in New Jersey by more than an order of magnitude. So we figured out that if we're doing a good job, we currently have a cogen on campus, so we're very good at doing this already. If we do that in this situation, we're going to pay off that gas generator in less than 5 years with the savings. And over the lifetime of the generator, we're going to save the university huge amounts of money. The great thing for me is that I didn't have to make an argument to say that the research computing stuff needs generator backup, but we're going to have it. And so it's really exciting. Okay. I'll talk quickly about collaboration. These are all the groups that we've put together to bring collaboration together, and it's been hugely important. Getting governance, bringing people together, getting people talking is hugely important to the success of something like this. So in the future, as I mentioned, we're trying to coordinate the supervision of departmental scientific and Linux system administrators. We actually have one person who's doing this right now. That doesn't help a whole lot because part of the reason of doing this is to have backup. So this guy can back up that guy when he's on vacation because planes do have that little switch that when a system administrator steps into the door, it makes the systems crash in their server room for some reason. We need to collaborate more with the library and do things like Tom is going to be talking about. Lifecycle management. We really need to get a sustainable process in place so that we know we're going to have funding for the next system when one gets old. We need to always be looking at the new technologies that are coming up, and we need to be participating in virtual organizations more. We need to work with other universities, with the supercomputing centers. So these are the things that I've learned through the process of building the cyber infrastructure program. Number one, research is driven by the faculty. The university is driven by the faculty. We are there to serve the research mission and the teaching mission of the university. Trust, relationships, and most importantly, partnerships are essential to success. Research computing relies on the complete cyber infrastructure of the university. Not just building the large systems that people can use, but it relies on everything. Avoid fees. Never use fees. At Princeton, fees don't work for the faculty. They're happy to contribute capital funds. They don't want to pay fees. Change is constant, and it'll keep changing. Start small, do things well, and growth will follow. And finally, it's all about the people. So now I'm probably way over and need to hand it over to Tom.
Thanks, Kirk. Mm-hmm. Do you mind teeing me up?
Yeah.
Hi, folks. Gotcha. When University of Washington actually had a reasonable football team, I used to say we're a football team attached to a medical center, attached to a university that is incredibly decentralized. So the story I'm going to tell you is how in this decentralized milieu, you know, we're bringing in $1.4 billion a year or something in research funds. Everybody's off doing their own thing. Central IT is not doing much of anything to help the research enterprise. So we puzzled our way through this. This is the story of that and some of the things we have done. So here's the presentation. I'm going to tell you how we figured out what it is our IT folks, our researchers are doing, excuse me, then describe their needs as we found them, and then talk a little bit briefly about how we met their needs. So the process we engaged in for understanding what our researchers were up to. We had something called the Conversations Project, and I'll say just a bit more about that in a minute, but these were the goals, you know. What do researchers want to do next? What is the role of technology, and what do they need? So, you know, Central IT and another partner called the eScience Institute, we literally went out and interviewed a bunch of researchers, 50-plus members of our staff, who, mind you, had never left their office to go talk to anyone in the research community. We went out and we did the interviews, and we found out no one else had done this, so that was kind of fun, but it was just a large, massive set of interviews. You know, this is how we picked the participants, people bringing in a lot of money, award winners, peer recommendations, and we ended up talking to about 130 folks. We also gathered a bunch of data from a triennial faculty survey that we do, and you know, we inserted some questions on those things. You can read that. So we had a couple ways, the face-to-face and the personal. Let me not trip on the cord here. And then gathering data, and we had 500 respondents there. So that was a pretty good base. And I do have to say, to play upon the notion of partnership, in relationship, simply going out and interviewing these folks and listening to them and as they passionately describe their work was a huge way to build those relationships for us in Central IT with our staff and their staff. So what were their needs? I mean, it was interesting when we disaggregated what they were doing. You know, a lot of it scheduling, but pushing around files of all sorts and a lot of database stuff, data management, in a whole bunch of different ways, was the primary activity that these folks are engaging in. And so there were really sorts of six sets of needs. The first was for IT and data management expertise. You know, they had grad students doing stuff for them, rather than doing research. They didn't know how to design systems to manage and handle their data. They didn't even know who or what was available on campus to help them. So this cluster of needs around IT and data management expertise. They needed the infrastructure as well to manage the data, storage, data backup, data security. There's all kinds of stuff that was publicly available, potentially, that shouldn't be, you know, three big problems. But they didn't have the infrastructure for it. And the stuff that they had, they didn't have the expertise to run very well. Of course, they needed computing power, cycles, places to put the machines other than closets, more and more bandwidth. You know, we've got sensors all across the Pacific Ocean floor generating reams of data, bringing it back into the UW, and we just needed more bandwidth. Fourth set of needs, just general communication and collaboration. You know, folks are working with other colleagues across campus, across the world, and they're doing it via email or they're calling each other on the phone. You know, simple, low impact technologies, video conferencing, web conferencing, if we made it easy for them to use, it would improve their lives immeasurably. And just everyday technologies. I mean, do they have wikis available that they don't have to mess with to set up? Websites, you know, these were all problem areas. Data collection and analysis, you know, the visualization that Kurt talked about, they didn't have a lot of capability of doing that well. And they didn't know how to make sense of their data oftentimes. They needed help with the analysis piece. And simply new ways to collect it. We've got a lot of folks out in the field with sensors, with handheld devices. They weren't doing that well. They needed help with that. There was also just a set of things that fell under the category of additional resources that they needed. Centralized information about what's available, group pricing on stuff. You know, the other interesting thing, all the talk that we're all familiar with about learning management systems, and that seems to occupy a huge amount of mind share for higher ed technology. And yet, you know, these people do research every day. They do it with their students, and learning management systems don't allow them to use you know, their research computing or their research technologies in a learning situation. And this is a big sore spot for our faculty. They want systems that allow them to gather data, collect data, analyze data, work with their students, use it for teaching, use it for learning, share it with colleagues beyond the university environment. So that was an important need for additional resources. Communal labs and equipment, another need. So these were all the needs. What do we do? There were two assumptions that were shot through everything that we needed to bring to the fore for at least the University of Washington's leadership. Number one, you know, we had to continue to maintain our really good networking infrastructure. That was simply had to be done. And our administration needed to know that and fund it. And fortunately, this came out of the interviews. You know, people didn't say, hey, keep up the networks, but everything they did depended upon this. So this was really key and helped us go after a large amount of NSF funding. But also, and we were a little surprised by this, people were very receptive to cloud-based resources, whether they were things, clouds that we built on campus, or Amazon, which is, you know, just down the road, or Microsoft, which is just across the lake, or Google, which is where all our CSE grads go. They, you know, they wanted to use this stuff, but they didn't really know how, and they needed some help. So how did we take care of them? We developed sort of a new data management paradigm. It's not just hardware, but it's having expertise, people who can come in and help you figure out what to do with your data, how to do good queries, you know, how to set up databases, how to do data mining, how to do it securely. So we've developed a set of folks who can come in episodically and work with researchers on these tasks. And the hardware, right? But without the knowledge to go with the hardware, people just weren't using the hardware very well. Key to this was what's called the eScience Institute, and it was, well, you can read that, but it was funded in 2008 by our state legislature and then has since grown and grown through grants. And those are the experts. They come in and consult with researchers across campus, you know, about all the things you see here. So that's been really instrumental in helping us, you know, develop this new data management paradigm. And just to give you an idea, that's their website. And there's a lot of interesting stuff there. If you're interested in this model, you can learn more about it from that site. But we've also built web-based applications to help them deal with data. And just one that I'm going to briefly mention is called SQL Share. You know, we cobbled together grant funding, the PI, the eScience Institute. And really what we've got is a web-based front end where you, without needing a DBA or really to even know that much SQL, can dump in your data and query it. The application itself runs on the Amazon cloud. The data parsing and analysis runs on a Microsoft SQL Azure cloud. And this web-based interface allows you to build and share queries, use other people's queries, share your data, with people inside or outside the university in ways that you want to. So it's this flexible community building online DBA in a way. And it's just enabled a great amount of data sharing and analysis and allowed people in different disciplines to connect in ways that they never would have because they log in and they see somebody's SQL queries and they go and find this person. So it's been really great at building connections. And just another screen of what that is. The other thing that we've done quite a bit as a central IT organization is just on-demand expertise and consulting. We weren't originally configured to just drop in and work with somebody for a couple days on a project, but they said they needed that, and we reconfigured to do that. And it's generally these things, you know, the data management stuff, but even more security and the networking sorts of things. Again, a lot of stuff, there were already a lot of pre-existing solutions on campus, but nobody knew about them. So one thing we did on the eScience website is gather documentation about these solutions. You know, there's how do you achieve your research goals, common technologies. So we stuffed all this information in one place, how to use Amazon Cloud, you know, all that stuff, interviews with people on campus who are doing the work. And this, is again, has allowed the expertise to spread out and people to find one another. We also did make more computing power available, and it's a lot like the kinds of systems Kurt has built at Princeton and described. So we've got a cloud for compute and data storage on campus. It's nice and flexible, can be on demand, pay as you go. This was really important, actually, so scientists and researchers could do their work. A lot of federated authentication so that they can create online contexts to work with their colleagues across the world. We made web conferencing, using Adobe Connect more ubiquitous. A lot of cloud-sourced applications. We made it really easy to do stuff using Google Apps and Windows Live in the research context. So just some simple stuff to allow them to do their work. We've created a research commons. We do monthly Ignite sessions, where you've got 20 slides and 15 seconds per slide, and people present for 5 minutes. People come in and do their work, and these are well attended. And we've just been identifying collaborative opportunities. When we bring people together, we're able to identify these mechanisms for group pricing. The next generation of our eScience presence, there's community blogs and calendaring and events. So, again, finding a way to bring people together. Yes?
Before I forget, when you say that you have this service, pay as you go, what are you trying to recover, 100%?
No. No, the provost funded a big chunk of it, some of the deans have funded, and it's quite inexpensive. At this point, it's actually cheaper than a comparable Amazon service. So, I went through this quickly. There is the documentation about everything I've talked about. But I think the key takeaway is go out and talk with the researchers on your campus and ask them what they need. They'll tell you. And that's, the initial step for building trust. But that, for us, we would have been lost. We would have been off in the wilderness. Having no clue as to what that community was doing. And it wasn't that hard once we knew to reconfigure to meet those needs. So that's it. Do you have any questions for us? You stunned into silence? It depends. I mean, it's like the first little bit is free. But at a certain point, yes, but, like on many campuses, people are using their postdocs to do, IT and not research. And so, they're now, we work with them on their grants, they write money for these services into the grants, and then we can provide them with that episodic IT expertise in a host of ways, and they get it paid for, through their grants. So, initially, just finding out that they needed it and then working with them to build it into their grant cycles has proved really effective. We haven't found that's the case in the last few years. It is easy to get money for hardware, but, NSF knows the score. I mean, they understand that this leads to great efficiencies. And a lot of grants, make a specific nod to cloud-sourced resources now. Amazon gives a lot away to us to use in that regard, too. So once they start utilizing this stuff and see how flexible it can be, that opens the door to more as well.
You both mentioned that some of the research community was using, grad student help for the support of their IP. In either of your campuses, were there any areas where there was professional IT staff, but they were off as islands, they were working to support the researchers, and if so, were you able to leverage that so that there's central IT resources working with those distributed IT resources to deliver a now more regular research computing kind of solution?
Well, I mentioned the initiative that we're doing specifically for that. We're trying to bring the departmental scientific Linux sysadmins more into the central fold.
Those were people that were already on staff, they just weren't on central.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. We've had a very strong program at the university for the Windows Mac OS 10. We have what's called our SCAD DCS program, and that's very well coordinated. But for the more, most of our scientists are interested in Linux and doing more scientific things. And for those, we're trying to create a different group that's in some ways more technical or at least technically different that focuses on what the what the scientific researchers need.
So once you got organized that way, or once you connected those folks with central research IT, Did anything about the way those people were funded change?
Not yet.
Is it coming?
Hopefully not. I mean, there may be, you know, there may be some changes, but we don't, right now we just would like to get people working together and covering for each other and contributing to the central. It'll make it more exciting for the IT staff to be able to do stuff with these big systems as well as what they have in their departments, so.
I think we're out of time. You might want to talk offline with some people.